I associated professional behavior with masculine behavior. Never let him see you sweat, never let him see you cry. Meanwhile, I just collapse into a puddle of tears. We're talking in the office. If in that moment you care so deeply about building this business and helping your team succeed, that you allow a little bit of emotion through, is that traditional masculine behavior that we associate with professional growth? No. Is it appropriate in today's professional world? I would say yes.
You're listening to episode 14 of Success Unscripted. I almost didn't release this episode, and if you listen to the whole thing, it's pretty obvious why. I basically start crying the ugly cry at one point, which I think is partly because I'm pregnant now and even more emotional than usual, but truth be told, I've always worn my heart on my sleeve. And while I have countless memories of times when things would have been a lot easier had I been able to stifle my tears, I also know that there are plenty of times when my involuntary vulnerability has allowed somebody else to feel just a little bit more comfortable in their own skin. So I decided to release it after all, in part to practice what I preach, and also because my guest today, Christine Raby, is such an inspiration and it would have been a shame to lose the nuggets of wisdom that she shares. As always, thank you for being here. I'm your host, Sarah Roberts, and you're listening to Success Unscripted. I want to talk first about just the concept of like taking ownership over your professional growth and identifying and filling knowledge gaps. I think sometimes it can be really intimidating when you look at people who are have reached a certain level of success and it's like, I want to get there, but I don't know how.
Mm-hmm.
So what's your advice typically?
Well, I love this question because I spend a lot of time talking to young people who are just getting started, whether they're in university or they've got a year or two of work experience. And no hate to Gen Z. Okay. Love Gen Z. Got a special place in my heart for y'all. You're teaching me a lot of things. One thing that I feel like y'all could learn differently if I'm speaking to Gen Z is that follow your passion is the worst advice of all time when it comes to career, right? Because passion by definition means something that you are compelled to do, something you're obsessed about. And so rather than the age-old follow your passion, just think about what brings you joy. No, for me, I want to know what energizes you, right? Were you on the track team as a kid or were you a gymnast? Do you like the team sport aspect or are you more of a solopreneur? What are the things that interest you? And a specific example for me that completely changed my career trajectory and honestly set me up for the career I have today was pivoting in university because I came into four-year university with a lot of biology credits already and I was studying biology. And I cannot tell you, Sarah, how much I hated being in a lab. I mean, the goggles, and you'd be in a lab for 4 hours doing organic chemistry, and you weren't even doing anything valuable, you know? So I would just figure out the cheat code for what we had to show that day, and I would hack my way around it and get out of there in an hour. And all my TAs hated me, but whatever, I got the grades I needed to get, right? And then I took a sociology class for the first time because you have to fill in some extracurriculars, right? This is required. You have to have a certain amount of social sciences. And I took sociology of family. And I was enamored. Like I was up at 1 a.m, ignoring my biology textbook, not caring at all, but reading everything I could about this invisible force that shapes our lives. And I immediately realized I could study sociology all day, every day. I could get a 4.0 and not ever feel like I had to work. And so I switched my major. I ended up getting a minor in health sciences because I'd already completed it, right? And a minor in Spanish. So I was still set up for my medical school track. But I loved the sociology aspect of studying, and I really enjoyed leaning into that. And that set me up for career and customer success, where I effectively negotiate with people all day, right, and navigate complicated systems. And that's the thing I like to do. So what I encourage people to do, because it can be really intimidating, right, to think about, I could go anywhere, I could do anything. That's awesome, but it's also scary. So first, pause and say, what currently brings me joy? What kinds of activities do I like and what kinds of industries or things interest me? And then following that curiosity and innate interest, I think will actually lead you to the thing that's going to get you started. And then once you get started, it's easy to build from there, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I love that you said that. And I was hoping, because this was in our brainstorm and I was hoping you were going to say that like following your passion is terrible advice.
So hard.
partly because that's actually something that
I don't say it in those words, but I do say my goal in bringing these conversations to a wider audience and just in the work that I do one-on-one with people is helping people find work that they love. But I think it's a really interesting distinction that, you make that, if you just say do what you're passionate about, then, and I probably thought this way when I was in my teens and early 20s is like, oh, well, I want to be Britney Spears, or like, I really like cooking, you know, like it's not, passion. I think adult professional passion is different than just like your hobbies and what you like to do in your free time as a kid. And that's not to say that they can't, like I'm noticing my camera back here. Like I was really into photography, and what I do as an entrepreneur is like very related to graphic design. And there is, you know, a lot of, so there's the creative element, but it's a, it's a different flavor of that. And I think that's a huge call out. Okay. You might like making, and actually you can make a lot of money doing TikTok videos and you're well on your way, but like, just because you like being on TikTok doesn't mean that that's going to be your career. Giving yourself the opportunity to explore different things, like you're not going to know until you do it. Just like when you got into that science lab and you thought this is what I want to do, and then you're there and you realize, oh, not so much. And that's and that's a lot of what being in the workforce is figuring out what it is that makes you tick, that keeps you up at night in a good way and in a bad way. And that's so different for every person, because a lot of people would love to be in a lab and would hate to do the type of work that you're doing. I love what you said about like what gets you excited. I think there's, I think sometimes we ignore that, almost like a your physical response to things. You know, like sometimes we're go, and you don't sit and think like, okay, what is my body telling me? Because if you have anxiety, like you're going to feel it, you're going to feel those chemicals. And if you're excited about something and you love what you're doing and time is passing, you're going to have a lot of other different chemicals. So like kind of picking up on those cues, I think is can sometimes be a good way to go about it. I want to also, you said before that like part of the problem with the way that we're taught in school how to do things is that, you know, everything's for a grade. So there's typically a right way and a wrong way to do things. Right. And like, that's just not the case in the real world. And again, as an entrepreneur, like sometimes it can be almost, it can also almost like stop me sometimes because it could be so overwhelming how many different things I could be doing and different ways to spend my time. But like, I mean, even if you're working for somebody else, that's the case too.
No, absolutely. And I love the focus of taking control of your career. So to your point, figuring out where you want to go. Step one. And if you don't know, then optimize for optionality. What does that mean? Try to get yourself into a role where you're going to have a lot of opportunities to learn and try and do lots of things. So I actually think if you go to work for a startup really early, if you're working for a founder who knows what they're doing, and by that I mean they have successfully built businesses before, they've got at least 10 years of work experience. I'm not saying that there aren't a lot of really bright whippersnappers out there founding companies at 22. That's great. But I am saying that I wouldn't recommend that a new graduate go work for one of those people unless there may be some sort of a savant software engineer and that's really their calling and they feel passionate about that thing to the extent that they want to incorporate it into their work life, right? But generally speaking, if you can assess different job opportunities and you think, you know, over here, I'm going to get a front row seat to a whole lot of different things, then I can assess what sticks and what doesn't. And oftentimes we are really bad judges of what we are good at and what we are not good at. So if you would have asked me a few years ago, are you introverted or extroverted? I would have said, oh, I am incredibly socially inept and very introverted, because growing up I was, but not today. I've blossomed, I'd like to think, into much more of a social butterfly. And I'm leaning into that aspect of my life now. Yeah. But I had to have people stop me in my career and say, you are exceptionally good in front of clients. And I would take that as a nugget and I would think, okay. And whenever people give you feedback, which they do, I tend to recommend ignoring it. If you've heard it once, just let that go. If you hear it twice, listen up. But if you hear something three times, right? If you hear someone say, wow, you are amazing at really selling the vision of a company to a candidate. And you're like, maybe recruiting is my calling, right? And really incorporating that into your career plan, your trajectory, because then you can be the one in charge of where you're going and understand that this is not school. So you cannot raise your hand and say, I have the right answer. Because guess what? There is no right answer. The right answer is what's best for you today, this month, this quarter, this year, at this season and time in your life. And having that moment to pause, to assess your physical body, which is a great point. We do absorb what's going on around us in a physical way, really paying attention and then saying, what do I want? And then being prepared to get it.
Say more about that.
Well, that's a quote I recently heard someone use from Maya Angelou, which is be prepared to ask for what you want and to get it. And so oftentimes in your career, you might think, ooh, I'd really like to be an enterprise program manager. And today I'm only managing mid-market projects, but I don't think I'm ever going to get there, right? And I had a member of my team in that exact situation, and I was preparing him to grow his career in that direction because that's where he told me he wanted to go. But it's knowing what you want really opens those doors, because if he hadn't spoken up, you know, in our skip level one-on-one to say, hey, I'm really interested in what happens at this higher level, how do I get there? Maybe I wouldn't have benchmarked him for leadership in the same way that I did, because he proactively spoke up and said, I'm interested in it and I'm willing to do the work. I'm not coming to the table saying, hey, I need a 20% pay raise if you want me to do this work, right? I'm not grumbling, right? I'm not working, no offense to DMV workers, your job seems very difficult, but I'm not pulling a, that's not my job, government byline here. I'm saying, this is what I want for my career, and I'm going to experiment with it and see how it goes.
Yeah.
But the most important thing for folks, especially when they're starting out or when they're resetting, right? Because we've all been at the place in our career where we stop and we say, is what got me here what will get me there? And what do I want next, right? And then being able to say, okay, well, what is that next move for me? And if you're just starting out, it's experimenting and it's trying a bunch of things. Or maybe you've already moved to a certain direction in your career and you have a lot of experience in one arena and you're like, I don't want to be an accountant anymore. What other branches of opportunity are available to me? Oh, hey, maybe I can go into the finance branch of a startup where I can use my accounting skills, but also be more on the business side, for example.
Yeah. I want to circle back on that. That's not my job mentality, because, and I actually want to take it in the opposite. Like it just sparked an idea of something else I wanted to talk about, of like setting boundaries. It's not like I'm not going to do this because it's not my job, but if I'm going to do it, you better know that I'm going above and beyond. I think there's a real danger, especially when you're young and you're excited about a startup and you want to make an impact and you're like, I'm going to do all the things, you know, oh, you need help with this. I'm going to do this. And that's all great. And taking on extra projects is a great way to figure out what you love to do and also to prove that you can do more than what you're assigned to do. But I think that there's a real danger of people taking advantage of all that you can accomplish.
Yes.
If you get hired for one thing and then you say yes to everything that's piled on your plate, and all of a sudden you're working way more than 40 hours and you're doing it with a smile, all of a sudden people are just going to set that as your new standard of like just what you're expected to do.
I noticed this happen with one of my closest friends who used to work for, I'll call it the Hogwarts of Ivy League schools. And she started there straight out of graduate school. She went to UPenn for master's in higher education. She started as a temp and she worked there for 5 years. And she was managing their pre-college program, which was the only profitable program at the time in that entire section of the university. And eventually she worked up to being an assistant director, which was amazing. But she kept telling them, look, I need temp staff because in the summer we literally have 300 high school students on campus and I'm responsible for all of them. They're living in dorms from internationally as well. So kids from all over the world were going there. And she was like, look, I just need people on site in person, right? And then peak pandemic, of course, they were remote, so it was a little bit easier. But she said, look, I need seasonal staff. They wouldn't hire. Eventually she quit because Hogwarts told her, listen, you've been remote for 2.5 years, but it's time to come into the office again, you know? And she was like, I live in another state now. I'm not doing that. Yeah. So she quit. She got a better job paying her more to do individual contributor work. But I remember talking to her and I said, well, what are you going to do in your next gig? You know, and she said, well, after watching them hire literally 5 people to replace me, mixture of part-time and seasonal people, because they actually could not hire a single full-time employee to do her job. And after them paying her out almost 3 months of unused vacation time over that mm-hmm. 5-year period, because she said, literally, if I took vacation, high school kids might not have the support they need. Like, I can't leave a 17-year-old just hanging, you know? Yeah. She said, I'm going to set my own bar. And I was like, what does that even mean? And she said, you know, I really want to make sure that when I'm delivering work, I feel good about the quality of the work. But now is not the era of my life for me to be perpetually raising my hand. You know, she was going into this new job 3 months after becoming a mom for the first time to her little girl. And she said, I'm going to do my job really well. And I'm going to aim to work about 30 hours because I know I'll end up working about 40 if I aim for 30. But now is not the time for me to volunteer for extra projects, to do a lot of client work travel, to go above and beyond all the time. Now is the time for me to use the skills I have to be efficient and effective at my job so I can focus on my family. And that's what she wanted to do. She was like, look, in a few years, I might want to dial it up again and go into more of a director position because that's what she'd been groomed for, right? But for right now, I'm going to set my own bar. And I really love that thought of taking control of your career and setting your own bar for excellence and quality, because that means that you are in control of your own work-life balance and you get to decide when enough is enough. You're saying, this is what I want for my career and I'm going to go after it, whether that's stepping it back and quiet quitting the unnecessary work that we often get tasked with as women, right? Or really ratcheting it up and saying, now is my moment to shine because this is going to set me up for big things down the road and I know it. And I'm ready and I'm excited to do the work.
Yeah. I think that's a perfect example of that dichotomy too, though, of visibility versus output. Mm-hmm. Where she was doing the work of at least 1.5 people.
And easily. So, she used to literally sleep on campus, Sarah. She slept in the dorms during the summer. That is that's unreasonable.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what's your advice for people that are in a spot where they are doing more than the job that they are hired for? I mean, I'm sure it made her feel good that when she left that they, you know, were completely lost without her and were probably like, oh shit, we really should have appreciated her. But wouldn't that have been nice to have happened while she was in seat?
How to set boundaries with a shitty boss? We've all had them. I've at one point, I was a very bad boss. I will admit that about myself. So having been one and having worked for many of them, I can tell you this. The most important thing for you to do is understand what your boss cares about. The first thing I like to open with is, what is your North Star? And then no matter what they say, I don't care what it is. When you are organizing your priorities set or whatever it is that you're doing that week, I want you to take that North Star and then deconstruct your tasks for the week and couch them within the frame of that North Star. So if the CEO says, I'm super heads down in fundraising right now, the investors are concerned about our margin, right? And then I'll say more about that. Why are you concerned? They're concerned about our margins and they're worried about our hiring plan being too high. And so then I look at my work and I say, wonderful. I am going to focus on our customer book of business because if they're concerned about our margin, we should really be packaging professional services and selling them. So let me go meet with finance and make sure that we have a plan to demonstrate to our future prospective investors that we will in fact be charging for professional services at this next echelon of scale because we will no longer be a Series A scrappy startup, but we will instead be a growth stage company instead of early stage, right? And that gives us the leeway to be able to say, we've done this 100 times. You now get to cough up the cash, Mr. Client, to pay for our expert professional teams to come in and implement. Voila, automatically increased your margin by 15%, by literally just billing for professional services. Mm-hmm. And that's all I did that week. And I had a really nice plan package for the CEO, and I gave it to him in a way that I knew would be easy to distribute to investors because I've raised a lot of venture capital funding over the last decade. And he was delighted. Did it matter? Did anything else that he asked for matter? No. That week, that's all that mattered. Maybe that month, that was all that mattered, to be honest. And then he said, can you get your group to be revenue neutral? And I was like, I could get it to be revenue positive. Absolutely. I have three models for you. No problem, right? Because I knew that was the next question. So mm-hmm. for you, it's less about reactively doing all the stuff that your boss is shoving at you. Like if you're in that mode, I would strongly recommend if you can take a week off. And I know that's speaking from a place of privilege because many people can't take any time off. So if you can't take a week off, at least a day to really mm-hmm. reflect on all the things you're doing, write them down. And then use a 2x2 matrix, which is my favorite little framework, right? You literally draw a graph on a piece of paper or an iPad or whatever you got going on, or the sand at the beach if you're on vacation. And you're like, hey, can, can't.
Yeah.
Will, won't. And so then you just map out all the things you could be doing, all the things that you can't do for whatever reason. And then you put it on your framework and you realize, okay, I can do these things and I will do these things. And then when you communicate what it is that you will do, make sure that you're speaking to the need of whomever is making the decisions. How can I help him solve his need in a way that helps me too? Because of course I'm selfish. Like I'm at the heart of my own story. We all are. Main character syndrome is real. And in doing that, it's less about telling your boss, no, I'm not doing that extra work that you're shoving on me, right? And it's more about intentionally and proactively creating the work that you want to do and then educating them about why that work helps them solve their problem.
Yeah. Yeah, that's brilliant.
Also, sometimes, look, you just got to do work that you don't want to do. And like, that's the job. So if you're experiencing that more than 10% of the time, you're reactive, you got to go on offense, right? And sometimes I will say, if you've been on defense for a long time, and you're in an environment that is not conducive to your long-term growth, it's worth at least considering what leaving would look like, right? Because mm-hmm. we can all kind of work ourselves into these roles within our career where everyone sees us as that glad-handing, happy helper or that really dependable one who always shows up and does all the work. And if we really want to step it back, sometimes you do have to rip the Band-Aid and make a change, but it's worth at least experimenting in the sandbox because worst case scenario, you're going to leave anyway. So you might as well try some things in the interim as long as you have enough risk tolerance to allow you to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I'm going to go off topic a little bit. So again, as I don't want to make you blush too much, but as I said at the beginning of the call, like, I mean, you are just one of those people where I feel like insights just like drip out of your mouth and like out of your pores and like, and just these incredibly brilliant things that you're saying and that you know, and the way that you exist in the world, just, it seems so natural and easy for you, which I'm sure not everything's easy. I want to hear about a time that you failed.
Ooh. Yeah, lots of massive failure. Also, I love that you think that about me. You know, at one point, I reached out to the recruiter who I was working with very closely on a tech company. And at the time, I was an executive and I was doing 8 to 10 interviews a day because we were growing. And I was looking at self-care things to buy my friend who's really into self-care a nice birthday present. And so I reached out to her and I said, Izzy, do you have any recommendations? Because I feel like you're really on point with your self-care. You're always so well put together. And she's like, I love that you think that about me. I have no self-care regimen at all. And I was like, oh, okay. So that was what sprung to mind when you were saying those nice things, which I appreciated very much. And I will say, you know, failure is the greatest teacher, but also no one wants to fail, right?
Yeah.
So when people tell me, oh, I want to fail fast within the startup context, I'm like, no, I want to succeed. Okay. If I fail, I'd rather fail quickly, but I don't want to fail at all. Of course, it's scary, right? As an individual contributor, the first tech gig I ever had was working at a company called Noom. And today they're known for consumer weight loss, but at the time they were looking to make a foray into the enterprise healthcare space. And I was coming from a public health background, having applied to medical school and turned it down to work full-time for Noom. And I showed up my first day wearing a full Brooks Brothers suit because it was a Brooks Brothers factory outlet where I used to live. It was literally a trailer. So you can get these suits for $40. It looked great.
Oh my God.
And so I show up and then I asked them where the fax machine was. And God bless the operations leader. She's still their SVP of finance, Denise. She's so nice. She was like, "Do you mean the email fax?"
And wait, I was looking what year around. This?
2013.
Okay.
But in the hospital, we were using the fax machine on a regular basis. Okay. The fax machine was a staple part of my life. Like, I used to climb the stairs to the sixth floor of my little clinic to use the good fax machine that was in this tiny closet. So I immediately identified that I was a stranger in a strange land within the context of this wild startup ecosystem. Yeah. And I very quickly learned that I'm completely out of my depth. And then my SVP of strategy boss quits. So within 2 weeks, I'm now responsible for all business development for all of the enterprise efforts at Noom. I'm running an accelerator program. We've got stakeholders in Korea, in Japan, in the UK, in Germany, and I know nothing about business. Now, I did buy and sell racehorses as my first job, so it turns out I knew more than I thought I knew, but I had no formal business training, and I had no business being in the room. Their CEO used to tell me all the time, Sage, you would say, "You're so lucky. You're so lucky you got here." And I was like, "I love that you think I'm lucky. I feel tired. That's what I feel. I don't feel lucky right now." You know what I mean? And so to give you that backdrop will help you understand the incredible stress that I felt when I made this particular faux pas, which was to mistakenly negotiate a deal, believing in good faith that the person with whom I was negotiating was telling me the truth, because I was so naive. I was maybe 24, not yet 25, and I felt like, oh, naturally people would not make a business deal if they couldn't make good on it. Little did I know that a lot of people have very little integrity. And so I structured this deal, and it was supposed to be $6 million for year one, and it was with a company that no longer exists, although the woman who ran that company is now running another company, and she still has a reputation for being absolutely bonkers, like, for good reason. So I'm working with this lady. Let's call her Linda. It's not her name. It doesn't matter. And we're using this structure over the few months, and we have this entire plan baked, and I've talked with customers, and I've at this point committed to venture capital investors for a Series B round that, yes, this is at least $6 million, but really more like 12 if we actually executed on it. And then I flew out to Colorado for our first go live, and I got to their offices. There was no one in the office. And this is not peak pandemic. I should specify, okay, this is still when we were all like working in the office. And immediately alarm bells start going off. And I'm like, well, where's the customer? You know, we're supposed to be meeting with this large customer, this large health plan in Colorado. You've heard of it. It's the biggest one there is in Colorado. And we're supposed to be meeting with them in their corporate offices. Where are they? And then as I unwound it, I realized that this was all just vaporware. It was all smoke and mirrors. They had absolutely nothing. They were just trying to ride the tail of being the in-person service provider for the kind of digital program that we were delivering. Oh, right? And because I was 24 and I had no formal business training, let's just be nice to myself for a moment here.
Yeah.
Never, ever, ever should I ever have been in that position to negotiate something like that. And I did it in good faith, and everything on my end was correct and complete. But the biggest mistake I made was allowing it to get to me, because this woman calls the CEO and starts swearing at him, telling him that if he doesn't fire me, she's going to report him to, I don't even know what authority, I think the CDC, again, pre-pandemic, so we all believed in the CDC, right? Like Santa Claus. And then we realized, no, no faith should be placed there. Let's be real. You and the WHO. Complete failure. Okay. Get it together. But at the time we still respected them. So I think she threatened to like report him to them or maybe to CMS. I can't remember. And she told him that he should absolutely fire me because I was insane and I was horrible. And also words I'm not going to use on this classy podcast, but you can fill in the blank, this kind of conversation. Meanwhile, I just collapsed into a puddle of tears. We're talking in the office, like full on panic attack, crying. I run to the stairwell, because again, we're in Chelsea in a one-bedroom apartment, okay? Everyone can see everyone else. There is nowhere to go. Mm-hmm. So I run to the stairwell, like I make my own emergency exit here, collapse in this puddle of tears, and God bless him, their chief psychology officer, who was a psychologist, stepped into the room, brought me a glass of water, made sure I was okay. And then my boss, shortly thereafter, after I get it together, and like, I'm not a pretty crier, okay? I'm a very ugly crier. It was real obvious that I was sobbing in the stairway, like in this one bedroom apartment in front of all of my colleagues at this new job for which I had turned down medical school to be in this new career for which I had no training or expertise or right to be in. And then I knew if I messed up just once, I'd be kicked to the curb immediately. So you can imagine the sense of dread that I was feeling when I got called into my boss's office and he sat me down. And by office, I mean a closet without windows. This was genuinely like a walk-in closet in New York City that was an office. And I sit down and he looks at me and he's like, hey, I just want to let you know I saw the mess with this situation. And I want you to understand that I looked at all the work that you did and it was excellent. You did really good work. Everything should have worked out. But this lady, Linda, cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs over here, known liar and cheat, completely defrauded us. And so I've already informed the board that we're going to be changing our numbers, but good news, actually the work that you did on the digital side shows that we can sell in the same way that they were going to sell, but now we can sell to their customer base. And we know who they are because we already did all this work, right, to develop this partnership, which is now defunct. So we can actually take that pipeline and go just pitch directly to all of them because they were in violation of their contract. So great work. Also, just like take a minute because it seems like you need to get yourself together. You can leave my office now. And I was like, you know, like maybe like Will Smith in Wild West where like he's going to get hung and like the noose is somehow bouncy because it got swapped out. I was like, did I just escape that? Oh, and then he called me back in and he was like, oh, by the way, I see you're only getting paid $65 a year. We're going to change that to $85. You should be getting paid more. And I was like.
And this is your failure story?
No, because I was so, I failed. I lost a $6 million deal. I mean, for me, I thought I lost my job. I thought I lost everything. And I was walking into that meeting absolutely expecting to be just shit canned. Absolutely. Just walked out of the room.
Yeah.
Hey, give me your laptop. Get out of here. We don't ever want to see you again. Because I failed so miserably. And what I realized was that actually the work that I could control, I did well. And then any other kind of negotiation I had from then on out, of course, I did a lot more diligence, right? And
yeah.
I have a much better nose for when someone was pulling the wool over my eyes and when they were actually speaking truth to me. But learning that very early on, learning that even when things have completely derailed, like I was about to resign. I mean, walking into that office, I was like, maybe I can at least just bow out as gracefully as I can. I've already sobbed in the hallway. What's left for me here? You know, turns out years of work were left for me and like a great ride of growing a startup that I honestly thought I would never be able to see because I had failed so dramatically telling people, putting my name out there and saying, yeah, Linda and I, we're going to build this business that, of course, never came to be.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Okay, so I have a similar story with a very different ending.
Mm.
In the type of recruiting that I've always done, it's 100% commission.
Mm, okay.
Yep. And so I joined this recruiting firm, and they really sold me, and the first week I'm there, I'm talking to a bunch of different candidates and I have the owner of the company get on with the candidate that I thought was worth moving forward so that she could pitch this client of hers and also get a sense of the candidate and all that. And there were like, I don't know, 10 different recs that I was working on. And I was talking to all of these different candidates and I made the mistake of, I think I told her that she should pitch this one company when it was for a different opportunity, which by the way, also like, couldn't you look at the resume and realize like, maybe I mixed it up. Anyway, so she gets on the call, starts talking to him and then starts pitching it. And I think he might've corrected her and she was mortified. She gets off the phone and just starts laying into me. And I go into my office and you know, when you get so stressed out that you feel like you're going to like barf and poop at the same time. I was like, I quit my job for that. Like I'm remembering back, like, I feel like I'm going to cry right now. So stressed.
Yeah.
This is me being pregnant. I'm so emotional. Oh, fuck.
Yeah.
Give me a second.
Whew, I've never cried when telling this story.
Sarah, you're pregnant. And we're editing that out, but like, I've been there. I get it. It's okay.
Oh, and look at my nose now. Fuck.
We have plenty of time. You want to just like take a minute and get some water?
Yeah. Get a tissue.
Yeah. I'll get some water. Okay, getting back in it.
Yeah. Anyway, so I go into my little office and probably have I didn't realize at the time, but was probably a full on panic attack. And she called me back into her office and she sat me down and she said, "Sarah, this is the reason why women don't succeed in business."
Whoa. Was your boss a woman?
Yes.
Whoa.
I'd quit a salary job to work for someone for free. And if I made placements, then I would get 25% or 50% of the placement, depending on. And I ended up crushing it. But yeah, I mean, I being emotional in the workplace is like so terrifying. And I when I was preparing for this today, I saw the TikTok that you did of it, where it was a true story where there were two people that were up for a promotion and the woman had just closed like $2 million. She was above quota. And there was a guy who was at 50% of quota and they were recommending that he get promoted because among other things, she was too emotional. Mm-hmm. And like, and I brought this up before on this show and I mean, it's hard to, because yeah, I mean, it's a business. And like at the end of the day, the business, the goals of the business need to be met. And you know, that's it. And so if somebody is constantly running around, you know, crying and making a scene, then like, that's not great for the business. But at the same time, we are humans. And so for me, like, and being somebody with anxiety and, who can cry at the drop of a hat. You know, I always say like, there are a lot of reasons why I became an entrepreneur and some of them were things that I was moving towards. And some things were things that I was moving away from and that I still probably have, you know, doubts about myself and what I would be able to, you know, bring to the table. And so, so yeah. So, I mean, was that the only time that you'd cried at work and how do you navigate it? And how do you navigate it when someone on your team is crying at work or on a podcast?
yeah, I am definitely a crier at work. I wish I wasn't, for the record, but yeah. I think I want to answer that in a slightly different way because my journey as it relates to showing emotion professionally has been a little bit of a roller coaster. And I now have a very different perspective than I would have several years ago. And I can tell you why. So when I first started working in technology, I was the only woman on the team and one of the only people on the business side under the age of 40, right? So again, I gave up medical school. For me, this was incredibly high risk. And I felt like I was just absolutely in a place where I had no right to be, right? And the only solution I had to meet this anxious need of mine was to work really hard. And I said, look, at the end of the day, they're going to have to throw me out of here. Literally, I'm sleeping on this futon in this office. I'm ashamed to say I did sleep on that futon. It was gross. There was a shower there too. I used it. I know. But I learned so much at that company and I really cut my teeth and I earned the right to be there from my perspective. But again, it was me showing myself that I belonged there. But that meant that for me, showing emotion at work involved me being in a room, again, the bigger closet. There were two closets in this apartment. One was bigger than the other, you know, classic New York City problems. And I would shove myself in this room and there'd be 10 men and there's no air conditioning in there. And I'm the only woman and the only one under 40. And I'm getting questions fired at me left and right. Where is this deal at? How much money are we going to make here? Why isn't this product moving? And that kind of tone, right? That kind of like intense bravado. Yeah. These are all New York City sales dudes. They're all physically intimidating. And my boss was the CEO of a publicly traded company for a while before joining the startup. And he was incredibly intense and was the CEO of the startup. So day in and day out, I was trying to be as masculine as possible. And I associated professional behavior with masculine behavior, yeah, which meant I wanted to be one of the guys. So when we went out to sales meetings, I shot whiskey. Macallan 12 is pretty good, but I prefer the 25, you know? And I would wear dresses because I intentionally said, I'm a woman and I'm going to wear a bright red dress suit today because I can. And I was very, very, you know, focused on never letting him see me sweat, never letting him see me cry, and always showing up as one of the guys. And then I went to go work for a boomer age woman who I absolutely love, who's now very much a friend-tor in that she is my friend and also a mentor. I love her. And she specifically said, never let him see you sweat, never let him see you cry, right? And she was very intense when it came to managing me. I found out later she tried to fire me a few times, but I was like the cockroach on the team. Like she just couldn't kill me. So I'd always come back from the brink. Because I joined her team as the youngest one there. I had the least qualifications and I really was kind of over my skis and she knew it and she didn't want to deal with me. I don't blame her. You know, and then coming out of that, I went to be an executive at a company for the first time ever, and I'm hiring a team, and I get to work with an executive coach. And you know what he tells me? He's like, you, after taking the survey, I now know for a fact, feel everything and you show nothing. And what that does is it tears you up inside. And so you are probably in an extreme amount of pain. You're probably feeling that moment that you mentioned earlier where your body is just forcibly rejecting everything, right? And you're panicking inside, but you don't let anyone see it. And that, more than anything else, is what's holding you back. And I was like, what do you mean I'm the only woman on this executive team? Like, I can't show up here, you know, mamby-pamby. What am I supposed to do, cry? And he was like, I mean, honestly, maybe. You know, because when you're presenting to people and you're saying, this is on fire and it's burning really hot, and if we don't leave the building, we might all die. But all they're hearing is your tone and your positioning, yeah, and they feel like you're in control of everything and they feel like you've got it. And so they're not really paying attention to you. You need to wave the flag and say, shit's on fire. It's going to burn down. Like, that's what you need to do. And in order to do that, you have to loosen up a little bit. You have to show them some emotion. And I was so terrified to do this. I didn't do it for weeks. And finally he said, look, you either try, you know, shit or get off the pot. Like, what are you going to do? And yeah, I was like,
yeah,
okay, I'm going to try it today. I don't know how or when, but I'm going to try it. So I was on this call with a client. Her name is Allie. And she worked at this Midwest health system. And we'd been advocating for them to change their build because our product was set up in the wrong way. We didn't know what we didn't know, right? Startup. And we were trying to get her to completely change the way it was set up. And it was going to be a huge project, but we also knew it was going to be massive for their business. And we thought, if they don't change, they're going to churn because our product's just straight up not working for them because it's misconfigured. But I have to get her to agree to do the work. And she wouldn't do it for like months. And so I get on this call and I used emotion. And I was like, Allie, I am not going to leave you. I care so deeply about this. And I was being genuine about it, but I almost felt like I was almost going to cry. And my coworker, who worked with that really intense woman with me at the previous company, looked at me like, this is pre-pandemic. It was only a phone call. Like, who are you? You know? And I just like really let the emotions show and try and through. And Sarah, it worked. She was like, okay, we can start on Monday. And I was like, you know, happy dance. You can tell I'm a great dancer. This is my happy dance. It worked. I've been trying to convince her to do this for months and I've been stuck and I just like couldn't crack through, and she wanted the emotion from me. That's what she was looking for. And so now when I'm managing or when I'm working with someone, I like to acknowledge the emotion. I like to say, yeah, you're crying or you're upset because you care. So to your point, if you're always on the verge of tears, something has gone terribly awry, right? We got to dial it back. We got to look at what's going on. We've got to assess. Or you're pregnant. That's also a thing, you know, or you've got something physical going on in your life, or you've got like a life circumstance that's happening that you should acknowledge. But if you're in that moment, like the example that you shared that I demonstrated through TikTok, If in that moment you care so deeply about building this business and helping your team succeed that you allow a little bit of emotion through, sure, is that traditional masculine behavior that we associate with professional growth? No. Is it appropriate in today's professional world? I would say yes. So for you, it's about straddling that line, but also understanding that using emotion can be an incredibly effective tool, and it can make you much better at what you do. And for some of us, like me, it's very scary. But if you know that you're inherently a more sensitive person, I think that historically we've labeled sensitive people as being weak or somehow inferior to those people who can keep it together and show the world that the world may be burning down around their ears, but they don't care, right? The James Bond, the plane is flying off the cliff and it isn't started yet, but he hasn't started to sweat. We're not all James Bond, okay? And that guy was drunk half the time. Let's be real about that. If you've read the books, you know this to be a fact. So I don't think I want to be a plane crashing drunk man running around the world shooting people. Like, that's not what I aspire to be professionally, right? And so if we're thinking about what is this new world that we want to usher in, where is there space for using emotion in a healthy way? And how can we acknowledge that it's coming out of a big feeling, whether that's anger or upset or frustration or whatever, and then channel it effectively instead of saying, oh, well, that woman cried in the sales meeting, so we shouldn't promote her. That made no sense.
No, it made a lot of sense. I just feel like you said something that I've needed to hear for 10 years.
Have you ever heard Quiet? The Power of Introverts in a World That Won't Stop Talking. Mm-mm. It's an amazing book, and the primary thesis is that a lot of folks feel as though we need to somehow be in the shadow or be in the background, and that leaders are strong and that they demonstrate that through loud voices, but that really it is those folks who are more introverted, more introspective, and more in tune with themselves and who have that higher degree of sensitivity that shape the creative forces that move our world forward. It's fascinating. It's won all sorts of awards. I read it twice. I loved it so much. But it's Quiet. It's great.
Well, it's already in my shopping cart. I also put Ask For It in there.
Oh, Ask For It's fantastic. And if you wanted to jam on some practical tips on how women can negotiate differently than men, like, I'm totally open to it. But I will say Ask For It and The Myth of the Nice Girl are my two go-tos. They're both very easy to read. I think Ask For It you can read in 90 minutes. And then The Myth of the Nice Girl is very similar. It's a business book, right? So it's written to be read on an airplane.
Cool. Well, I definitely do want to go over all that stuff at some point, but I think I need to stop.
Well, it was so fun talking to you. I really appreciated being on the podcast. I love the work that you're doing. I'm excited to see more of it and just really appreciate you brightening my day and giving me a reason to think about these things and to talk about how we can make the workplace a better place. Really enjoyed the conversation, and I'm just looking forward to hopefully a round two in the future, whether recorded or not, whether with scotch in hand or not.
It means a lot. And I mean, and that's the part that I love. I think I feel like I've been like behind the eight ball for so long. Like, I think maybe it is time to kind of put a pause on the recording and start to like, just really look at what I have. And I think that will also help me with the direction I want to go. When I start really like slicing and dicing the stuff that I have and figuring out what resonates with me and what I want to do more of. So
I think it could be interesting as well for you to have that time to lie a little bit fallow and to reflect on, you know, how do you want to think about your core audience and who you're speaking to? Like, when you close your eyes and you imagine that you're recording this podcast for a friend to listen to, who is that friend?
Well, it's all good advice. And thank you so much for your time and for, I mean, being so thoughtful. And you're very inspiring. I admire you a lot, and I'm so glad to know you. So
thanks so much for listening to Success Unscripted. I typically release episodes every other Friday, but I've decided to wrap up season 1. So the next episode, episode 15, will be my last. I do hope to do a second season at some point, but this pregnancy has been extremely challenging, both physically and mentally, and I've decided to take some time to both focus on my primary business and, more importantly, on nurturing this little baby that's growing inside of me. My hope is that this time off will help me reflect on previous episodes, tighten up my message, and allow me to bring you even more valuable content in the future. Releasing a podcast can sometimes feel like you're operating in a vacuum, so I mean it when I say that I welcome any feedback that you may have, good or bad. Easiest way to find me is on LinkedIn. Thank you so much for going on this journey with me, and I'll see you in 2 weeks.